Putin is dead. Or so we're told by a rather dubious anonymous Telegram channel. But the point is, its dubiousness does not stop a whole bunch of Western media outlets running with the story. Why is there this willingness, this fascination, to look for all the stories about Putin's alleged illnesses or indeed mortality? And does it really matter? I would suggest it does. And if we're talking about what would happen if Putin does die, well, which he will in due course. In the second section, I look at the, shall we say, most obvious, at least interim successor, Prime Minister Mikhail Mishustin. Hello, I'm Mark Galliotti, and welcome to my view of Russia in Moscow shadows. This podcast, of varying length, frequency and format, yet always reassuringly low production values, is supported by generous and perspicacious patrons like you, and also by the crisis exercise software company Conductor. On Friday the 27th of October, the General SVR Telegram channel had the following announcement. Dear subscribers and guests of the channel, yesterday, in the afternoon, the health condition of Russian President Vladimir Putin began to deteriorate sharply. At 20:00 Moscow time, the doctors on duty called an additional team of doctors who, upon arrival, within 15 minutes, began resuscitating the president. By that time, Putin's condition was critical. At 20:42 Moscow time, doctors stopped resuscitation and pronounced the president dead. After informing the security officers on duty at the door about what had happened, by personal order of Dmitry Kochnev, who incidentally is the head of the Federal Protection Service, the FSO, a room in the presidential residence in Valdai, which was converted into an intensive care ward in which Putin died, was blocked off. The doctors remained locked in with the president's corpse. Security officers ordered the doctors to calm down, not to make any noise and wait. Dmitry Kochnev carried out the instructions of the Secretary of the Security Council of the Russian Federation, Nikolai Patrushev. Also, by order of Kochnev, the security of the president's double was strengthened. Now the question, including the future fate of the doctors, is being resolved. Negotiations on the creation of a coalition of representatives of the pro-Putin elites under the leadership of Nikolai Patrushev are almost completed to preserve the current regime and use Putin's double in the image of the president. But, there are now three exclamation marks there. If, when Putin was alive, it was possible to use a double without any problems, in extreme cases it was possible to present the real one, then, after this, Putin's death, any attempt to pass off the double as the president is a coup d'etat. Shortly before the president's death, when it was already clear that he was dying, the option of putting Putin into a medically induced coma was considered, thus preserving a fresh corpse, so that after a clear determination with a successor and a smooth transfer of power, could present the freshly deceased to the public. But this option, due to the death that has already occurred, has disappeared. And how his surroundings will act is also being decided. We will inform you as information becomes available. So, in what sounds frankly more like a scene from Armando Iannucci's brilliant Death of Stalin, we are told that Putin is dead, that his corpse has been stuffed into a fridge freezer, refrigerate in peace, and Patrushev, a man with no constitutional power, has essentially taken over, planning to use a Putin body double to rule through. And somehow, whoever is behind this Telegram channel knows details to the very minute, but no one else does. Is it totally impossible? No. But do I believe it? Absolutely not. Look, this is a very, very dubious and sensational social media channel. It's long been peddling a conspiratorial line that suggests a mortally ill Putin who periodically goes through humiliations such as falling down the stairs and soiling himself is represented in public pretty much at all times by a body double and is about to be supplanted by Patrushev. In this, although it claims to be the account coming from a general in the SVR, the Foreign Intelligence Service, and let's be perfectly honest, if anyone with this degree of access was publicising it, don't you think by now someone would have identified the person? I mean, there's only so many people who would be able to tell you, for example, at exactly what time Putin, quote-unquote, died. Anyway, but still, there are very, very close similarities between its fictions and those of the defrocked academic Valery Salovey, who for years has been predicting Putin's imminent demise or deposition. Really? Yep, absolutely. In 2017, he said that Putin would stand down in 2 to 3 years. In 2018, he said that a major crisis would topple Putin in 2019. In 2019, he said that Putin would be out in 2020. In 2020, that Putin had Parkinson's disease and would be dead or out of office in 2021. In 2021, he claimed that, guess what, Putin would be out in 2022. Are we noticing a common theme yet? Salovey is always predicting that Putin is going to go any day now. And look, of course, someday he'll be right, on the same principle that a stopped clock is accurate 2 times in the day. Salovey is also responsible, though, for some of the more, I think it's fair to say, lurid claims about, for example, Putin turning to shamanistic blood sacrifices to try and restore his health. And also that Patrushev is precisely the sinister Eminence Grise, whom he is, about to take over, which is much more questionable. Not least because of the health issue. Look, let's not forget that, I mean, obviously, I have no idea whether Putin is seriously ill, on the verge of death or whatever. But let's imagine, just for a moment, that the director of the CIA might know something more than me. Well, just last year, CIA Director Bill Burns said, as far as we can tell, he's entirely too healthy. So we need to take this carefully, and especially given the rest of the rather outlandish suggestions and apparently exposés that General Esver also peddles, not least by the fact that Yevgeny Prigozhin is alive and well and living in Venezuela. Look, it's worth noting, first of all, since then, you know, we have seen Putin at nuclear exercises. Now, again, sure, this could be a body double. And for the record, I think there is at least one body double, because although on the whole Putin has a phenomenal security around him, we have seen cases where he seems to be pretty much interacting with a genuine crowd with relatively little security. Whether this was in terms of his drive around in the occupied Mariupol, or whether it was then his post-Prigozhin coup, couple of little sort of public events in which, again, he obviously wanted to show that he was still a man of the people. In those cases, I would not be surprised if it was a body double, not least because Joe Public, or I don't know, Ivan Public, you know, do not know Putin well enough to be able to perhaps see slight differences in his cheekbones or whatever else. These are the sort of things that people who look at obsessively, I would say, at some of the sort of media pictures say, oh, look, this clearly is not Putin because of the ears are different or something. I don't know. So, yes, in some cases there could be a body double, but nonetheless, we appear to have seen Putin out. More to the point, I would say there's no signs of panicked conclaves in Moscow, no sort of big black limos trundling to each other's dachas and such like, no evidence of the security forces being brought to a precautionary alert. And look, Patrushev may perhaps, and I'd stress that perhaps, control the spook agencies, though again, I don't think we should be too quick to assume that he has the kind of power that would actually make them become participants in a coup. But beyond that, the Embedded, the Interior Ministry, or the military? Look, if we're essentially talking about the arithmetic of a coup, when it comes to who has more guns, it's probably people other than Patrushev, people who indeed may well want to ensure that Patrushev does not become dominant. So generally, we have absolutely nothing to support these claims. But, as I said, that does not mean for a moment that it does not get picked up in all kinds of news agencies and accounts all around the world and retweeted and such like. Now, why is there this willingness to accept the most, I was going to say likely sourced, but unsourced gossip. Well, look, in part it's precisely because, of course, Putin, his home life, his health and so forth, are very, very private. This is the blackest of black boxes. So in some ways there is no genuine information or credible information, given the degree to which we don't obviously trust what Kremlin spokespeople tell us, to supplant the rumour. A, if we're blunt, copy-hungry Western press is very happy to run this, and sure, they will use the get-around of not saying Putin is dead, but shocking new revelations from social media channel claiming. But the point is, it's sexy, it fills a bit of space. They really should do better. But anyway, that's my own particular pet peeve. There's also a degree, obviously, of wishful thinking, that if Putin dies, well, A, thus Putin dying may well be regarded, with good reason, as good in its own right, but also the implications this might have for the war in Ukraine and such like. But most importantly, because obviously Putin's health, Putin's fate, really does matter. This is an intensely, well, at least at the top, personalistic system. And over the years, 23 years after all, it has in some ways become moulded around Putin. As I said, I mean, to go back to my usual vision, which is that this is a fairly modern, bureaucratic, institutionalised state with a medieval court perched atop it. Well, that court is now shaped by Putin, by people's relationships with the boss, by people having acquired a whole variety of habits and behaviours about what you can and can't, should and shouldn't do, because, of course, you are seeking the boss's favour and wanting to avoid the boss's anger. Generally speaking, then, it is like that whole medieval concept of the health of the nation being inextricably linked to the health of the monarch. And even if some kind of a successor wants to preserve the Putin system and all the prejudices and policies that go with it, well, can that person squeeze into the Putin-shaped hole at the heart of it? And the answer is almost certainly not, especially because in some ways it has evolved over time. Putin today is not the same Putin as in the year 2000 or indeed the year 2008. So for all of these reasons, we cannot assume that there will be a smooth, seamless continuity when Putin does go. Even the most Putinistic of successors will bring changes, just in terms of their character, as well as the impact of, let's say, their age and their health and their vigour, but also will be unable to rule quite like Putin because they will not necessarily have all the same personal relationships and the like. So it really matters because of the personalistic nature of this regime. It also matters because there is no clear successor or even a succession mechanism. We have, and I'll come to it in a moment, the constitutional process, but that presupposes that what really matters is the constitution and the law. And of course, we all know that this is Russia. It doesn't. The elections which would follow are not necessarily going to be, and I don't think I'm sticking my neck out here, free and fair. To a large extent, they will be about the ratification, the legitimation of whoever has been chosen as a successor by the elite. But nonetheless, that process could get quite messy. I'm not anticipating shootouts in the centre of Moscow or warlords mustering their forces to compete over the throne, but we have to acknowledge that there is a lot of scope for conflict and contestation below that. Of course, the irony is also, and this is the last key point why it matters, is that trouble in Moscow, conflict in Moscow, could actually also mean the prospect for ending a much larger and much bloodier conflict, that in Ukraine. I would say that although I really wouldn't want to predict that there is a high likelihood that the war would be ended, but nonetheless, I would certainly say that the possibility that there could be an end to the fighting is vastly greater without Putin, without his own personal commitment to the war that he, after all, started on the basis of his own ludicrous notions of Ukraine and his own sense of what Russia as a great power needs. But also, if Russia now has a handy Putin's casket-sized scapegoat on which it can sort of dump everything that went wrong. It's also worth just dwelling on the question of whether or not this is actually, and this is a question I've been asked by journalists a couple of times in the last couple of days, whether or not, in fact, people like Salavé or channels like General SVR, are actually Kremlin operations deliberately trying to spread lurid disinformation. And on balance, I don't think so. I mean, yes, it does perhaps help discredit critics by putting out so much hyperbolic nonsense. But look, it surely cannot be good for Putin to be seen as debilitated and humiliated, let alone dead. So, you know, on balance, I would have thought that the cost is greater than the advantage. But we shouldn't underestimate the Russians' capacity to operate on the long game. I'm minded to go back to, in some ways, a very different exercise that happened after the Bolshevik seizure of power and the Civil War. The forebears of the KGB ran an operation called the Trust, essentially trying to run what looked like an anti-Bolshevik emigre organization committed to bringing down the new regime, precisely as a way of penetrating, incorporating, taking over similar emigre Russian anti-Bolshevik organizations, but also using it as a way of gaining access to information about Western intelligence operations against Bolshevik Russia. And it led to all kinds of arrests, imprisonments and killings of various people. So, you know, I suppose one could conceivably imagine that. But as I say, I think it's probably unlikely. And likewise, on balance, I don't think this is a Western black propaganda operation. Again, not impossible. There are reasons why you actually want to present Putin in particularly bad light. But if nothing else, I have a tendency to feel that everything leaks eventually. Now, I think it's more likely that there are people who, frankly, enjoy spreading these lines, enjoy seeing these lines being picked up all around the world, and have established for themselves sort of niches in presenting these things, and that's what they do. But it does raise the question of what happens if and when Putin does actually die, certainly if he dies in office. Well, look, constitutionally, what happens is, unless there are going to be immediate elections, which is one option, but otherwise, most likely is that the Prime Minister, currently Mikhail Mishustin, becomes the interim president, and there have to be presidential elections within 3 months. Now, in practice, what do I think would happen? Well, I really would expect something very much like the situation has happened when Stalin died in office in 1953. And it's worth noting that, frankly, General Svr's picture of what happened to Putin does sound very reminiscent of the Stalin situation. So what happened? Well, first of all, I think there would be indeed a delay in making any announcement while the not-so-great, not-so-certainly not-so-good behind the scenes try and sort of hammer out what they're going to be doing, who's going to be taking over, what the line is going to be, and while there are security precautions. After all, it's worth noting this extraordinary scenes that we saw when Stalin died of, you know, even people within the Gulag labor camps, people who were there because of the paranoia and malice of Stalin's administration, nonetheless, you know, bursting into tears at the news of his death. Not necessarily because they were sorry that the old bastard was dead, but because in some ways they could hardly imagine a Soviet Union without Stalin. He'd been in power so long, been so central. You know, he was the pole star. Other people had come and gone. Once they were heroes of the revolution, and then they were saboteurs and Trotskyites and non-people, their names taken out of the great Soviet encyclopedia. And in that context, the idea of them without the great helmsman was difficult to imagine. Well, look, I mean, I don't think it's going to be quite the same pitch with Putin. But remember, 23 years, that is an incredible length of time. There are people who not only will not be able to remember a pre-Putin Russia, but 23 years, there are people who could have kids who also can't remember, you know, Putin. I mean, this is going to be quite significant psychologically and very unpredictable. And although, again, I don't think it's going to lead to either sort of massive, genuine mourning of Putin, nor actually some kind of potential collapse of the system, but people won't know. People will be uncertain. So I said they will be making their security precautions. There will be, as I say, behind-the-scenes negotiations. And here I think it's important that there is no one figure who I think, in my opinion, can muster the power and the authority to be able to just take over. There is no obvious successor. There is no one who essentially can command, without horse trading, enough support across the board. What we will quite possibly find, though, is, again, as happened after Stalin's death, that perhaps some of the figures who are regarded by the rest of the elite as the most dangerous are marginalised or eliminated. I mean, again, Iannucci's film rather abbreviates the process, but 9 months after Stalin's death, Lavrenti Beria, Stalin's not just his secret police chief, but as he himself described him, my Himmler. Now, there's an accolade for you. Anyway, Lavrenti Beria, by that point, you know, 9 months, by 9 months later, he was arrested and killed. Well, it won't necessarily be quite that, but, you know, we may well see, and obviously my nomination would, by the way, be Igor Sechin, but anyway, we may well see some other figures losing out precisely because the elite can now get them out of the way. And through that process, we will see the emergence of probably some kind of a consensus candidate. Again, consensus does not have to mean universally popular. It just means we have enough of a support base. And a lot of that is going to involve not just who people are and what institutions or interests they represent, but also what they promise. If we look at, again, what happened after Stalin, there were essentially two key figures. I mean, there was the obvious successor, Malenkov, and then there was Khrushchev. And in due course, although Malenkov apparently started with all the levers of power in his hands, he was outmaneuvered by Khrushchev, who represented the party rather than the administration, which was just Malenkov's power base. And perhaps most importantly of all, Khrushchev managed to promise all things to all, whether that was in terms of continued defence spending for the military, whether it was in terms of the Virgin Land scheme, which is an attempt to kind of open up areas of Siberia which hadn't been under cultivation, which on the surface sounded very tempting because basically it would mean a large amount of additional agrarian revenue, which could then be exported in return for technology and the like, at no real cost. In practice, it was a ghastly flop. But like so many of these things, it was an inspiring money-for-nothing option that got people supporting Khrushchev at the crucial moment. And by the time it was clear that it was a disaster, Khrushchev was already in power. Now, of course, there are some big differences between 1953 and now. Most importantly, there is no Communist Party equivalent. Yes, there is the United Russia bloc, but it is not a powerful institution in its own right like the Communist Party was. So there's no party rules or party discipline. There's no Politburo or Central Committee, which ultimately becomes the locus of where the horse trading is done. You know, you have to be able to win a majority in both the Central Committee and the Politburo to become General Secretary. Now, there is no such obvious structure. Someone will emerge. And also, it's wartime. That creates all kinds of tensions of its own. People will have to find some way of addressing the question of the war. And it may be that, in fact, in the immediate political phase, whoever succeeds Putin is going to have to sound really tough on the war, if that's what it takes to win. Or maybe they're going to have to sound conciliatory, if that's what it takes to win. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it will be the policy that they adopt afterwards. But nonetheless, the war will clearly have to be one of these issues that people will have to address. And part of that may well mean making promises to people who are intimately involved in the invasion that they will be kept safe. And it maybe will be also be promises about the continuation of the war that will constrain policy options afterwards. So we'll have to see. Remember, whoever takes over is not going to just suddenly become an absolute and dominant autocrat. yes, they will be president, and yes, this is a highly presidentialized system, but the point is they will still be much weaker. In some ways, I can't help feel that they might be in a position a little bit like Gorbachev when he came to power on what was essentially an artificial majority in the Politburo. He knew that, certainly in those early months and years, he could not push too far, because if he pushed things through to, in effect, a vote of confidence, he might well lose it. So he had to operate a lot more cautiously than he might otherwise have done so, and particularly when it comes to Afghanistan, a war that he wanted to extract the Soviet Union from for all kinds of reasons. Nonetheless, for his first year, he basically had to give the generals whatever they wanted. He had to allow them to escalate the conflict, because in some ways he had to let them fail on their own terms, so that they too would be brought in to the consensus that this war had to be ended. So again, we should note the degree to which political necessities meant that a relative peacenik actually had to escalate the war in the short term. And given that, well, we'll have to wait and see whether it will be a relative peacenik that actually takes over. But still, you know, what I think might well be peace in the longer term might actually mean even more violence in the shorter term. But still, actually, the more I think about it, the more maybe the death of Stalin is a pretty good guide to what could happen after Putin's death, just in different ways than General Svr may well try and tell us. Just the usual mid-episode reminder that you're listening to the In Moscow Shadows podcast. Its corporate partner and sponsor is Conductor, which provides software for crisis exercises in hybrid warfare, counterterrorism, civil affairs and the like. But you can also support the podcast yourself by going to patreon.com/InMoscowShadows. And remember that patrons get a variety of additional perks depending on their tier, as well as knowing that they're supporting this peerless source on all things Russian. And you can also follow me on Twitter at Mark Galliotti, or on Facebook, Mark Galliotti on Russia. Now, back to the episode. Well, if I am talking about potentially Putin's death, it makes sense to look at the person whose job it is to succeed him, at least constitutionally. So we're going to be talking about Mikhail Vladimirovich Mishustin, economist, taxman, prime minister, digitalization champion, and I have to say, the sort of chap who looks a little bit to me like what you'd get if Humpty Dumpty became a mob boss. I'm not sure that I'd necessarily want to have a beer with him, but in fairness, he is a pretty impressive figure. He was born in Lobnya outside Moscow in 1966 of a Russian mother and a Jewish Belarusian father, who also happened to be a member of the Central Committee of the Komsomol, the Young Communist League, which can't have hurt Mishustin's life chances. He went to university to study system engineering, both undergraduate and postgraduate levels, and he graduated just in time for the wild 90s, as new Russia was opening up, and in many ways this was the ideal time for someone who knew computers. And he soon was working integrating Russian and Western IT, which was a big deal back in the 1990s, and in 1998 it got him a job as deputy head of the State Tax Service, again, precisely responsible for the information systems and digitization and the move away from essentially a paper-based tax structure. He was there until 2004, then had a couple of other middling highly placed civil service jobs until 2008. He left for the private sector, heading an asset management firm, and making some money. Before, in 2010, I should have said making some money legally, but never mind. Anyway, before in 2010, he returned to the government as director of the Federal Tax Service. It's worth noting that this position was actually within the gift not of the president, but of the prime minister. And at the time, this was when Putin was prime minister, during that sort of interregnal period, as he observed term limits by making Medvedev his sock puppet president. Look, I don't question Mishustin's suitability for the job for a moment, but I would say it probably doesn't hurt that he's another ice hockey fanatic, just like the boss. Still, as I say, it was a really good choice. He proved to be an exceedingly able technocrat, very much who combined an interest in simplifying the processes with massive digitization, to cut down on red tape, waste, fraud and tax evasion all at once. And this has been very much one of the themes that he took through, has taken through into his role as Prime Minister. The idea that acknowledging that there are, shall we say, some human level challenges in Russian administration. The answer to that, obviously, ideally, you'd have a massive army of highly dedicated, honest civil servants. But if you can't get that, then the next best thing is to actually take so much out of human hands and to try and put it into a whole variety of joined up databases and such like. This is undeniably techno-authoritarian, in that it brings a whole variety of new sources of information and thus new sources of control to the state. But the point is, it works. And fine, so for example, you know, every single cash register has to be connected so that it can send records of every single commercial transaction to the government. Now, on one level, that's great for checking on VAT, and VAT fraud had been a really massive area of abuse before Mishustin came to the State Tax Service. But it also, again, just provides lots of kind of the sort of big data which a modern authoritarian regime loves to have. Still, it worked. Certainly, most Russians, in my experience, kind of appreciated it, even if they didn't really want to be paying more tax. In January 2020, Mishustin replaced as Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev. Remember him? I have to say, it feels more than 3.5 years ago since Medvedev still seemed, I don't know, serious, sober and credible. But anyway, since then, Mishustin has very much embraced his role as Putin's head butler, the man who keeps everything below stairs working with a minimum of fuss. You know, he's certainly not pushing a high profile. I mean, he's around, he's doing lots of things. He's Prime Minister, of course he's going to. But, you know, we don't get the kind of attempts to build a sort of cult of personality or anything like that. Low fuss. Now, of course, it was an interesting, if not necessarily comfortable situation that he took over just in time for COVID. And look, we can poke holes the size of T-80 tanks through Russia's COVID responses. But one also has to recognise that, at least in part, and I think actually in quite large part, many of the mistakes and the blunders were actually down to Putin's reluctance, bordering on the outright refusal to actually take any real responsibility for what happened. Still, I think Mishustin's generally regarded by Russians, at least, to have done an acceptable job of dealing with that. And interestingly, in the process of dealing with COVID, he actually found some common ground with the other sort of comparable high-profile national-level technocrat. That is Moscow Mayor Sergei Sobyanin. You know, up to that point, their relationship had been, I think it's fair to say, cool. But apparently they would meet up during COVID every now and then for kind of mutual support and bitching sessions, because in some ways there was no one else they could really talk to. And since then, they do seem to have built a suitable working relationship. So, as I say, constitutionally, he would become the interim president in the case of Putin dying or suddenly being incapacitated. And look, as Putin himself discovered in 1999 to 2000, that can be quite an advantage to actually then subsequently winning the presidency. He does have other advantages. You know, he is a capable technocrat, and he absolutely would probably be regarded as a steadying force in a time of upset and turmoil. He's very well known. October this year, Levada Center polling gave him a 68% approval of his rating for his work as Prime Minister, and it tends to basically float between 66 and 70%, which is not at all bad. And in August, he had an 18% trust figure. Now, that might sound really low, but this is actually second only to Putin's 44%. So again, I think, you know, we have to kind of calibrate on that. It's not that actually the vast majority of Russians mistrust and despise Mishustin or anything like that. It's just that his rating is not the equivalent of Putin's. He is not directly associated with the war party, shall we say. I mean, at that infamous Security Council meeting before the invasion, you know, he was the one who suggested continuing dialogue with the West about the status of the Luhansk and Donetsk People's Republics before deciding whether to recognise them. Again, I mean, given that this was a situation in which everyone was trying to, A, guess at what Putin wanted, and B, be very cautious in how they advanced it, I mean, essentially, Mishustin was advocating not doing anything drastic. Well, Putin went and did something pretty drastic. And since then, look, obviously he has to toe the party line, but nonetheless, it's quite striking the degree to which he clearly has not in the slightest bit embraced the kind of over-the-top rhetoric of the Zed Patriots or anything like that. Instead, he very much tries to keep his rhetoric at a pretty low level and talks much more about the practical situation. I mean, for example, back in March, I mean, this is a quote that sort of caught my eye. "We're faced with the task of ensuring the development of the country's economy under the restrictions imposed by unfriendly countries. Russia is still part of the global world, so we will continue to expand and strengthen our trade and economic ties with those who are interested in such cooperation." Now, the reason I dwell on this really rather tedious little passage is precisely the point. A, it is fairly tedious because Mishustin is a fairly tedious speaker. But beyond that, I think it is deliberately tedious. You know, there's none of this talk about being in a war with the West. There's just these bland things about unfriendly countries imposing restrictions. Real emphasis on strengthening trade and economic ties with those who are interested in such cooperation. This is what he's been doing. He's essentially trying to manage a complex, difficult situation in which he's clearly not particularly happy with it. He's neither going to go out on a limb and say so, but nor is he going to, well, for example, take the Dmitry Medvedev route and instead indulge in performative, ultra-patriotic rhetoric. And beyond that, I think it's worth noting that Mishustin would, I think, probably be on the whole acceptable to the oligarchs. Now, on one level, one might think, well, so what? They're not exactly a powerful political force. Well, it's true that at the moment they are absolutely defanged by their fear that if they do anything that Putin doesn't like, he will essentially have them removed and take their assets. But they do still have assets. And having money at your disposal and rich backers is something that could be useful in the future. So, you know, these are reasons why we certainly can't discount Mishustin. But. It's all very well having the oligarchs on your side, but again, to go back to the earlier point, how many guns do they have? One of the questions with Mishustin would precisely be his Silovik flank, how he would get on with the so-called men of power. There are some suggestions that Mishustin has acceptable links with Igor Sechin, the Rosneft boss, who, after all, is also, you know, was once regarded as one of the kind of leading figures within the Silovik bloc. Well, firstly, I think that Sechin has a lot of enemies, not really the best friend to have. Secondly, I'm not convinced that these days Sechin actually has much traction amongst the Siloviki. So generally, it is a question of whether he would be seen as not one of us and not someone whom we could deal with ultimately by the security apparatus and the like. On a personal level, I understand he's a bit of a git. He's a bit of the old-style Soviet manager, that with his own underlings, he is brusque, abusive, shouts at them, etc. Now, on one level, one might think, well, so what? I mean, how many powerful people actually still manage to retain and expand their power base, even while not being the nicest of chaps and chapesses? But I think it might well matter in this case, exactly because of the personalistic nature of this. We don't really know who he may have alienated, and whether or not people will really want to subordinate themselves to them. It's different from being a minister in his cabinet. I think we might see that personality factors have an influence, not so much in making people opposed to him, but above all, raising the question of actually who would support him. Him in his own right, not as a compromised candidate or whatever, who actually is going to turn around and say, I will go to the barricades for Mikhail Mishustin. I'm honestly not sure where his real power base would be. And I think that's why it's uncertain how much of a definite advantage he would have over, for example, someone like Sobyanin. Though one could see a Mishustin presidency with a Sobyanin prime ministership, or even other lower profile technocrats like Marat Husnulin, whom I've already profiled. When it comes down to it, I think really Mishustin's greatest strength will precisely be that he doesn't have close allies, which means that he becomes everyone's acceptable compromise choice. You know, if you can't get your own guy, the next best thing is to make sure that it's not someone else's guy who comes to power. The question is really whether that's enough. So, yeah, President Mishustin, it's possible. He has time on his side. He's 57. He's apparently in decent health. He's managed to keep either most institutions kind of on side, whether we're talking about the military or the Russian Orthodox Church. After all, he has the proud distinction of having both the patriarchal badge of the temple builder and the order of the venerable Seraphim of Sarov, albeit only of third class. So he certainly hasn't made enemies. But is being a compromise candidate the if-no-one-else candidate enough? And also, that presumes that Putin doesn't get to pick a successor. I mean, it could be him, but it could be someone else. That none of the security types can force and muscle their way to the top. That no one with more sparkle may not be quite the right word for the succession of largely grey kleptocrats in equally grey suits, but shall we say wider appeal to the elite, but also to the electorate. After all, it's worth noting that, yes, of course, the elections will be rigged, but nonetheless, whoever takes over, it has to be credible that they can actually win the support of the masses. They will have to go and campaign. And Mishustin's approval ratings, after all, are as prime minister, grand administrator, shall we say, not leader of the nation. And Mishustin has never stood for or won an election. And finally, look, we tend to assume that everyone is after the top job. He may well not want it. After all, that's not really his thing necessarily. He seems to actually enjoy dealing with the minutiae rather than necessarily grand strategy. His family has something like $50 million worth of real estate, which at the current rate would be 4.7 billion rubles. It sounds a lot more fun when it's in rubles. So it's not just a question of whether he could do the job or whether he'd get the job. It's also a question of whether he'd want the job. I'm really not certain. But if all else fails, Mishustin is precisely the person who could end up with a job if no one else can get it, if everyone else basically gets blackballed and outmaneuvered by their rivals. Again, we're back to one of these figures whom not enough people dislike. And that may not be the final epitaph you'd want on your grave, not disliked by enough people, but actually, in politics, that can sometimes be enough. Well, that's the end of another episode of the In Moscow Shadow podcast. Just as a reminder, beyond this, you can follow my blog, also called In Moscow Shadows. Follow me on Twitter, at Mark Galeotti, or Facebook, Mark Galeotti on Russia. This podcast is made possible by generous and enlightened patrons, and you too can be one. Just go along to my Patreon page, that's patreon.com/inmoscowshadows, and decide which tier you want to join, getting access to exclusive materials and other perks. However, whether or not you contribute, thank you very much indeed for listening. Until next time, keep well.